Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
I have to say that my own acquaintance with the work of Martin Amis was moderate at best. I was actually transfixed by a novel of his called Other People, A Mystery Story. It was a little bit out of the norm of at least the really famous Martin Amis novels. It was a very different kind of piece of fiction, but I remember being just hypnotized by the book and just very aware of his powers as a writer. Anyway, Martin Amis, very famous as both a writer and a public intellectual, died last Friday. We are updating the interview we did with him in 2018 with some new information and a new interview with Dan Coyce. That's all coming up after this news. We're doing something a little unusual today. Well, we should say, first of all, that last week, Martin Amis, the novelist and nonfiction writer, died on Friday at the age, I believe, of 73 of esophageal cancer, the same disease which also took his very, very good friend, Christopher Hitchens. You know, they were sort of part of a group of people that includes Salman Rushdie. People have been trying to kill Salman Rushdie for decades, and he, like, did a public appearance last week. And everybody else around him has bigger problems. So we talked to Martin Amis in 2018, and so we're going to kind of Terry Gross him today. We are going to air parts of that interview, which was a good one, and he was on his game, as usual. But we're also going to begin by maybe sort of updating the information a little bit and talking to somebody who is a great, great admirer of his and more besides. And that is, well, ladies and gentlemen, he's an editor. He's a writer at Slate. He's a novelist. He's a journalist. He's known as the Jackal. No, he's not really. But he knows.
If only, yes.
But he knows to the penny how much money Jonathan Franzen has spent on his teeth. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Coyce, who is the co-host of the Martin Chronicles. I want to say, first of all, to my chagrin and embarrassment, like, I knew the title of your podcast, but when I looked it up by mistake, I looked up My Favorite Martin, which I think also would have been
a good... why didn't we think of that?
Yeah, I think that could have been a good title. But The Martin Chronicles is a, I would say, sort of limited edition at this time anyway, podcast in which you and some of your confederates revisit Martin Amis's work. But I think the first thing to do, Dan, is... for those people who maybe know the name but don't really have a full relationship with the work of Martin Amis, kind of locate him a little bit for people who are not in the know.
Martin Amis was the son of Kingsley Amis, one of the great British comic novelists of the mid-century and beyond. And he came into his own as a literary figure in the 1970s and 1980s, kind of an enfant terrible, an angry young man of British literature with a style and fizz all his own. He was, at that time, was writing comic novels that excoriated society in funny and fun ways, while also writing criticism and journalism that dug into the lowlifes and also a highbrow cultural figures that infatuated him. He was part of a cadre of writers of that era. You mentioned Christopher Hitchens, Salman Rushdie, also Ian McEwan. A whole group of writers were famous in the 70s for their long boozy lunches, followed by all of them going off and writing brilliantly in the afternoon, then presumably falling asleep. He sort of splashed onto the American scene, became better known in America in the 80s when he began the big trilogy of novels that he's best known for. They're sort of known to many people as the London trilogy: Money in the 1980s, London Fields in the early 1990s, and then The Information in the late 1990s. This trio of big, ambitious, zeitgeist-capturing novels were his attempt to sort of step out into the limelight and say to the world, this is the way we live now. This is a way of looking at the way we live now that you've never thought of. And every sentence of those novels zings with comic energy and a remarkable observation, even as the novels themselves overcome the many, many shortcomings that almost every Martin Amis book shared.
So at the risk of inflaming you, and it's a mistake to inflame the jackal, I was thinking a little bit based on everything that you just said, or maybe notwithstanding everything that you just said, I was thinking this morning about kind of whether Martin Amis is maybe a little bit underabsorbed into the canon, if there can even be such a thing. There's a way in which if he's on the kind of bleeding edge of if you know, then you know, and pervasive cultural literacy. And I'll give you two incredibly lazy examples on my part. Without getting up from my rolling chair in my office, I wheeled over to the bookcase and I pulled out the new Gale book of quotations or whatever it's called. But it's a very up-to-date book of famous quotations. And that book, 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die. And Kingsley Amis is in both of them. Lucky Jim is a book you're supposed to read before you die. And he's got some quotes in the Yale thing. Martin Amis isn't. Now, that doesn't really prove anything. But I think there is sort of a way in which he's not quite as canonical as maybe he might have even hoped to be.
Well, he certainly wanted, I think, that kind of recognition. And I think it would be a little bit of a mistake to feel sorry for poor Martin Amis for not quite making it into the canon as the son of one of Britain's most famous novelists, born into a literary world, and his stepmother was Elizabeth Jane Howard, another beloved British novelist, famously in the 70s, a group of British critics were trying to think of what would be the most unlikely name for a book ever to be published. And the one they came up with was My Struggle by Martin Amis. The guy was certainly born into a set of great circumstances. It is true that now in 2023, he doesn't have the kind of profile of, say, many of his fellow British writers who, for example, have won the big prizes. Someone like Kazuo Ishiguro, for example.
He's unbookered, I believe is the phrase.
He's unbookered, yes. He only even ever made the short list for the Booker Prize once. His books were often the subject of fierce debate, angry public debate among Booker Prize juries, some members of which loved him and wanted to canonize him and others of which hated him. He was the subject of a lot of jealousy, and I think he often encouraged that jealousy unintentionally or sometimes intentionally through high living, through reveling in the kind of public profile that a novelist who's not afraid to give good quotes can assume in England and could assume in England over the last 40 years. Every time a new book came out, he would make some other semi-deranged, semi-political pronouncement about Islam or about Stalin or about Donald Trump, and that would make people angry at him. I mean, he was sort of an expert at tossing these grenades into the culture, and his books were also kind of grenades. And some people don't like the effect a grenade has upon them when it lands anywhere near them. And so I think he was always a pretty divisive writer. That kind of divisiveness means that it's harder, I think, to get entree into the canon. I do think that's different now than it was, say, in the mid-1990s, when I think for most serious readers in the 1990s, the name Martin Amis was essentially synonymous with a literary author living a literary author's life and having that kind of admirable, remarkable career.
Absolutely. So I want to just build on a couple of things that you just said. One of them that occurred to me over the last day or two is that I think, there's a reason we're doing this show. There's a reason an awful lot has been written and said over the last few days. And I wonder if just in the way that we tend to celebrate frontiers just as they're closing up, there's a way in which Amis is a kind of person who exists and existed in a way that I think increasingly difficult to do. I mean, he wasn't careful about what he said. He denied refuting political correctness. He said he was okay with the idea of political correctness. But he wasn't a careful man. He wasn't worried about being canceled. And I think we're living in a time when people are increasingly careful about that. He's a guy who would have signed the Harper's letter and probably would have said it didn't go far enough. The Harper's letter was the one about sort of basically not canceling people all the time. But react to that idea.
I don't know if he was quite sensitive, I think, in his everyday life on the very matters that he was incredibly insensitive to often in his fiction. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in his sort of public statements, the kinds of statements he would make in the heat of a publicity campaign. I would say it's a mistake to sort of overstate the extent to which I think a lot of writers and artists are afraid right now. I do think there are some, you know, writers who quiver in fear that the next word they write will be the one that gets them thrown off Twitter or whatever. But I still think there are plenty of novelists who are out there basically writing exactly what they want to write, the way in the Amos tradition, without that much fear or even without that much connection to whatever world it might be that would cancel them. The way that I think of Amos as a kind of throwback is his idea of the novelist as a kind of public figure who matters not only in the artistic and aesthetic, but in the cultural and political sphere, that someone would look to a novelist to make these big statements about, you know, 9/11 and the war on terror, about Islamism, about the current political scene in England, you know, and the idea that a novelist over the course of his career should be producing the kinds of big books that grapple with the issues of the age and the great atrocities of history. You know, famously, his early books were, you know, funny, scabrous comedies, mostly revolving around characters about his age. Many of his later books were big, fat attempts to grapple with 9/11 or Stalin or the Holocaust. And he viewed that, I think, as part of an obligation of a serious author to address these kinds of things, that if you weren't doing that, you weren't doing the job. And I think that's a different idea of the job than a lot of novelists have today.
Yeah, I mean, I think he clearly viewed himself as a public intellectual. And, you know, Gore Vidal famously said, you should never pass up a chance to have sex or go on television. I think Amos probably hewed at least to one of those things, possibly both of those things. You know, I mean, he's on television a lot. And there's a way in which I don't think America really has exactly that kind of niche the way the UK does. That there's a literary novelist who is famous enough so that Fleet Street would care about his goddamn teeth, you know, and how much they cost. And also famous enough so that he would say something, you know, of an oracular nature about important public affairs at a given moment.
Right. I mean, the closest that America's had maybe in the last 20 years, I can think of two names. One is Toni Morrison, who sort of put herself at that level through pure power of the work, not only her literary work, but her work in publishing and her work as an advocate. But she was not called upon to sort of weigh in on the news of the day, the way Amos and many writers in England would be. And then for a brief period, you know, Jonathan Franzen occupied that in the sense that he found himself, against his will, great at creating outrage cycles in the, you know, in the era of his Oprah canonization and then decanonization. But he too is just I think a lot more retiring. And while he has strong opinions about the way the world is now, he has ended up mostly shying away from expressing those on a day-to-day basis. They come out when he publishes a book of essays or a new novel, and he's suddenly in the news, but then he disappears for 7 years to write the next thing. One of the amazing things about Amos is that he basically never turned down an interview opportunity. He never turned down a chance to opine, but yet every 2 years, like clockwork, there would be another book, a collection of essays, a collection of journalism, a brand new novel, a memoir in a couple of cases, that he was still doing the work of writing. He was still sitting at his desk and producing this incredible wealth of material, the stuff that I think he in the long run thought really was his legacy. Salman Rushdie wrote a very brief remembrance of him in The New Yorker this weekend, in which he said what Amos always said to him was, what you want as an author is at the end of your life for someone to be able to look at a bookshelf and go, you know, from there to there, that's him. And Amos never stopped doing that work, even as a million different controversies swirled around him.
You know, I know he's a tremendous influence on you and an inspiration to you, even as a high school student, I think. Did you ever have any contact with him?
Nope. Never met the guy, never interviewed him. It's a great regret of mine that I never had the opportunity to do that. And we started this podcast, The Martin Chronicles. It's, you know, me and Jason Zinnemann of The New York Times and Parle Sagel of The New Yorker about a year ago, sort of in part with the idea that this is a guy whose work demands greater attention and critique. And now that he's not the figure that he once was, it doesn't always get that attention and critique. And with the idea that who knows how long we have with this guy, who knows how long he's still going to be producing work. As it turned out, there was a year between basically when we started this podcast and when he passed away, a year in which we just have started to dig into the oeuvre. But it really seems to me that each book we dive into is tremendously rewarding, both in terms of things to admire and things to critique and things that we find shocking, annoying, and absorbing about the way he approached the work of writing.
So, by the way, I've just completely fallen in love with Parul Sigal's voice. And you and Zinnemann have been on the show a lot. As soon as I get her on the show, we'll never call her again.
She's like a world-class talker, Parul. Yes. You should get her on the show as soon as you can.
And I just also wanted to talk a little bit about him. Because I think there's a way, I mean, we're talking about him, but, you know, I think there's a little bit of a default in people's thinking to he's this rebarbative kind of prickly guy, you know, who doesn't suffer fools gladly and, you know, will tell off Ann Coulter or something, as well he should. But, you know, I'm listening to some things. Well, first of all, he was nice enough to come on my wonky little show, and I think he was pretty nice to me the entire time. But I was listening to this BBC podcast that is hosted by a woman who sounds alarmingly like Philomena Kunk. And it's like all people like mailing in questions, and there's a studio audience that's asking questions, and they're talking about one book. In this case, it's Money, and it's like 8 years after the publication of Money. And there's just, and Amos is answering all these questions, and there's just, he just seems very patient and congenial and nice. Now, obviously, these are fans of his work, but that doesn't mean they won't ask stupid questions. But I my sense was that there was this one persona that would maybe go on and you know, trade thunderbolts with some opponent on television. But he obviously got on wonderfully with his Rat Pack. And there are, you know, these wonderful clips of him and Hitchens, and Amos is talking. And you can see Hitchens just burying his hand in his face laughing at how funny his friend is. But I feel like maybe Amos is a nicer person than he gets credit for.
I think my impression is that for the majority of people he ever came into contact with, he was an enormous mensch. And I think it should not be surprising that he was famous for his friendships, that in fact, when one of those friendships broke up, that was news because those friendships were so famously tight. But when Julian Barnes and Amos broke up as friends in the mid-90s, in the imbroglio surrounding his novel, The Information, and its sale, that was news because that group was so famously tight for decades in supporting each one another's work and lives, and also being willing to argue in public. Amos and Hitchens argued in public and in print. Amos, in his book about Stalin, essentially accused Hitchens of, you know, being too soft on the death of millions of people. And Hitchens wrote responses. And then, as Amos said, that was it. Like that was what that entailed. Having it out in print was what their friendship required, and their friendship remained ever a spring afternoon, I think Amos said about it. And it seemed to me that he viewed his role in public as sort of launching these darts and yet representing a kind of power that literature can have to connect with people, that meant that in the most of his encounters with readers, he was not a scabrous individual. He was not sarcastic. He was not mean. He seemed to really enjoy the work of connecting with readers and talking to them. It was in dealing on the page with the world that he that he sort of let his anger and his dark and bitter caustic humor come out in full.
Just for those of you keeping score at home, Julian Barnes's wife had been Martin Amis's agent, and he dismissed her. He fired her and hired the real jackal, Andrew Wiley, in order to get this really famous advance that he got that was way big for a literary author.
£500,000, which, you know, now when you think about what it must be that surely Stephen King, or for that matter, you know, Richard North Patterson or someone gets, it's like nothing.
Yeah, but Martin Amis was a literary writer. I think that was sort of the thing. Not that Stephen King is a hell of a writer, but there's sort of a way in which he's a bestseller writer, and where Amis was trying to have it both ways, and he did, and people wouldn't forgive him. We have to stop there because there's this other guy who wants to talk. His name is Martin Amis. He is going to be talking to us from 2018 after this break. But it's always just an incredible privilege to have Dan Coyce, editor, writer at Slate, novelist. Most recent book is the novel Vintage Contemporaries. And are you going to keep doing the Martin Chronicles?
Absolutely. We got a lot more books to go through, and they're all incredibly fun. I'm sorry that we'll never have Martin as a guest, although we also deeply feared the idea of having Martin as a guest.
Yeah, I think it's better just to deal with it the way that you've been dealing with it. All right. Thanks for talking to us, and everybody just stay right where you are. No flipping, as Larry Sanders would say. We'll be back with Martin Amis.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
We're back. So as I explained at the top of the show, Martin Amis died last week on Friday at the age of 73. We talked to him in 2018. He had a book out at that time. First of all, it was called The Rub of Time, Bellow, Nabokov, Hitchens, Travolta, Trump, Essays and Reportage from 1994 to 2017. And he was very keen to talk about Donald Trump and his ascendancy to the presidency. He had been on a lot of television shows talking about it and was writing a lot about it. And so, although we've cut out a bunch of it, you're going to hear him talking about Donald Trump in the present tense as president. But we're going to just send you right now to the year 2018 in our conversation with the now deceased author, Martin Amis. Good afternoon, Martin Amis.
Good afternoon.
I want to start with two things that are of great interest to you, the rise of Donald Trump and the rise of the Nazis in Germany and the subsequent Holocaust. One of the comparisons that you've made is the day after the U.S. election, comparing it to Germany after Hitler's appointment as the German chancellor in 1933. You're citing the historian Sebastian Hafner. He said the feeling was not of horror. It was of complete unreality. You go out into the street and people look different. The commerce, the cars, it all looks staged for your benefit, completely make-believe, a sick-making feeling. And here it is. And what the F did they expect? I've had that feeling not just the day after the election, but I find these days, even now, that there's sort of a weird cognitive frame shifting that goes on, that I'm having a different experience of reality than I had in, say, 2015. Can you talk a little bit about that? What do you think? What is it that you are describing, that sense that Hafner describes and that you describe post-election?
Well, the feeling of surely there must be some mistake. And it's undiminished even now. Just every time I hear the clinch President Trump, I think there must be some mistake. That in fact the mistake is a category mistake. And he doesn't belong in this world of real politique. He's a reality TV star. But he said I could shoot someone down on Fifth Avenue without losing any votes. He, blunderingly put his finger on something that I think is true, that his supporters, his base in particular, think that he's not really of their world, that he belongs to the pseudo-reality of TV shows. So that's his immunity to a series of scandals that would have unseated every president from George Washington on. People are touching wood when they hear him because he's not convincingly real. It's interesting that the Hitler comparison comes up, and it doesn't come up very often, and nor should it. I mean, he has two traits that he shares with Hitler, and they're minor details, really. One is his revulsion at smoking and drinking, though he's not a vegetarian as Hitler was. And the other is obsessive cleanliness, what we would now call compulsive obsessive disorder. And he's admitted to that. So it must be quite extreme, I think. But what he doesn't share with Hitler, this is the crucial thing, is any great will to power. He didn't want this job. He announced his presidency to up the rates on his brand. And I think when in his sober moments, evanescent as they are, he realizes that he's in the wrong category.
I've been spending some time with your novel, The Zone of Interest, which takes place in and around a concentration camp. And you enter the mind of this commandant who has just started thinking about the world in a very, very different way, a way that is unfamiliar to most of us. And so if there's another comparison that I feel Martin Amis invites me to think about, it's kind of that one, that you get in these situations and you start thinking about the world in a way that you've never thought about it before and discarding old ideas that were rock solid to you a few years ago.
Yes. I was helped in that project by having read the memoir of the commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Höss. Mm-hmm. And his memoir is almost like a wonderful novel by someone like Nabokov, where it's not so much an unreliable narrator as a completely transparent narrator, and one who has gathered up this ideology, and that's what's powering him through. So I immersed myself in that book and began to try and think and feel like the commandant of Auschwitz. And I would sometimes plumb my mind for quote-unquote improvements in cruelty and unscrupulousness and stupidity. And I found that lurking in my mind were greater extremes of horror than the ones presented to me. And you can do this at some risk to yourself. But it's, you know, the great thing about fiction is that it's like looking at a tiger in a zoo, in that you've got these very reassuring steel bars between you and the creature. but, you know, I would like to write about Trump in such a way, mm-hmm. but it's absolutely much too early. You can't write satire about something that's still going on. It's a hostage to fortune, and famous examples of satire like Swift's A Modest Proposal about the famine in Ireland, that was written when the famine was had been successfully relieved, and Dickens writing about imprisonment for debt, which he did very fiercely in Little Dorrit, when that book appeared, imprisonment for debt had been abolished. You can only do it when it's over. Mm-hmm. If I do live long enough to write about Trump, depending on how long he lasts, it would take 3 or 4 years after he's over before I would dare put pen to paper.
Right. And I think instead what you've done is write quite a bit of nonfiction about Trump and his followers. You went to one of the rallies, as did I. You invoked the Clive James Barry Manilow principle, which is that everybody that you know doesn't like Barry Manilow and everybody that you don't know does like Barry Manilow. So this is another alien group for you. What did you learn from spending time at that rally and with them?
Well, my hesitant conclusion was that what they love about him, and they do love him, and as I'm sure you saw, mm-hmm. It's a sort of celebration of, I think, a celebration of stupidity. And Trump is in the marvelous position of saying to them in square brackets or in a whisper, you know, you're the left behind. You're the, you know, the those people who can't live in this accelerated world that we all occupy. You're not lifelong autodidacts. You haven't got degrees. And people call you stupid, and the elite sneer at you. But look at me. I'm stupid. I don't know anything. And I'm the leader of the free world and a billionaire to boot. This is, you know, a tremendous affirmation for those who are left behind when they think, I don't have to change. I don't have to take a night course in computer science. I can just go on in my, you know, blinkered way, and with luck, fortune will smile on me. I mean, it's a very simple transaction between Trump and his base. And let's not forget for a moment how allied to racism it is, and how it's a result of Obama, through no fault of Obama's own, except the color of his skin. You know, that it was, a baseline for Trump's core followers, but it's also for every white American. This idea that you're looking out of your trailer where you live or your cracker hut, and you're saying to yourself, you know, I may not. You have another opioid, and you say to yourself, I may not be much, but I'm better than any black man in this country. And when Obama appeared, that had to be revised, at least subconsciously. And it stored up a great deal of racism that that poured forth in November 2016.
By the way, I'm sure Cracker Hut is going to be an exciting chain of new restaurants, but I promise to you that we will not talk about Donald Trump for the entire show. But there's an interesting little bridge to the present moment. Martin Amis, one of your journalistic pieces here is a foray into the world of pornography and the people who make and perform in pornography. I'll read out one quick quote because I liked it so much. Porno stars, despite being very bad at acting, are very good at acting in one particular. They can keep a straight face. But then humorlessness, universal and institutionalized humorlessness, is the lifeblood of porno. So you're today, on this day in history, in a unique position, having made that particular journey into that particular underworld. Right now, as you and I are speaking, the aforementioned President Trump is going through a drama involving a person known as Stormy Daniels. So here we have Donald Trump, one of your fascinations, and a porno star who claims some real familiarity with him. I don't know. What perspective can you give us on all this?
Well, for a start, I think I can assure you I can stick up for the president and say that he never had sexual intercourse, and particularly not unprotected sexual intercourse with Stormy Daniels. You know, to return to his obsessive cleanliness, I don't, and this is the man who said that every vagina is a potential time bomb. And he couldn't possibly have had sex, even protected sex, with Stormy Daniels, because as the very intelligent and perceptive porn star I spent a lot of time with, Chloe, told me that she said, almost the first thing she said to me was, I have herpes. Everyone who works in this industry has herpes. So the really fascinating prospect is that we'll find out, you know, he must have done $130,000 worth of something with her. But I wonder what it is. I mean, it could be absolutely anything, like him throwing cream buns at her. And she says she has some sort of visual evidence of whatever it was they got up to. And whatever it is, it's going to be much more embarrassing than coition. We're going to get a glimpse of the polymorphous perverse in the person of Donald Trump, and there's no knowing what that would be.
I want to switch gears a little bit here, although I think we seem to work our way back to the big orange elephant in the room no matter what we talk about. But you've always written a lot about words, about your interest in the way language is used, much in the manner that Orwell was interested in the way that language was used. Orwell, of course, wrote about politics in the English language. I'll read the introduction just for people, or the first few words, just to remind the listeners. Most people who bother with the matter at all would admit that the English language is in a bad way, but it is generally assumed that we cannot, by conscious action, do anything about it. Our civilization is decadent in our language, so the argument runs, must inevitably share in the general collapse. It follows that any struggle against the abuse of language is a sentimental archaism, like preferring candles to electric light or hansom cabs to aeroplanes. Underneath this lies the half-conscious belief that language is a natural growth and not an instrument which we shape for our own purposes. You know, we've lived, Martin Amis, through a period where language, again, seems to be twisted around in ways that Orwell would both recognize and not recognize. As somebody who monitors the language, are there particular things that you're noticing right now that are happening to the English language?
Well, Trump is a sort of bull in a china shop when it comes to language. And, you know, Orwell was brilliant about this, but language has stood up. Usage is self-correcting. You take various deficits along the way, but it's still there as the central instrument. And we won't know for a while whether Trump has done it permanent damage or is just trying to do it permanent damage.
We're talking to Martin Amis right now. We'll take a very quick break here, and we will be back with more.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
We're back. I have to say some thank yous. This show spans so much time that it includes two completely different reigns of technical producers. Kion Wolf produced it in 2018. Kat Pastor is producing it now. And we are most significantly indebted to Jonathan McPants, who right away, when Martin Amis died, suggested that we could do something like this. We could take the show from 2018 and update it. So we have. He had a book out at that time. called The Rub of Time, Bellow, Nabokov, Hitchens, Travolta, Trump, Essays and Reportage, 1994 to 2017. This is, once again, our interview with Martin Amis in 2018. He died last week. Let's hear a little bit more from that day. All right, and we are talking to Martin Amis. His new collection is out. What we're going to do in the spirit of the collection, I think, or of any collection, is hunt and peck around a little bit here down the home stretch. And I promise you, we will explain what John Travolta's name is doing in that title among those other luminaries. But before we get to that, Martin Amis, one of the things that is done in this collection is occasionally we have these interludes where readers of a newspaper in Britain are allowed to send in questions, both respectful and cheeky, to you for you to answer, and you often answer them in equally cheeky ways. Is this something you enjoy doing? What's up with the questions and the answers?
They sent me a raft of questions, and I chose the ones I wanted to answer. And some of them were cheeky, and some were less serious than others. It took me, I did make a distinction in the piece about Christopher Hitchens about spontaneous eloquence. And Nabokov said, I think like a genius. I write like a distinguished man of letters. I talk like a child. And I was saying how exceptional Christopher was, in that he spoke in not only in complete sentences but in complete paragraphs. So I wouldn't have included a verbal, an oral interview. But since I did write my replies and they wrote their questions, I felt willing to include those two sections.
Do you enjoy those kinds of exchanges? I mean, I'm trying to imagine Updike, prolific though he was, doing something like that where people could write in and maybe even snark at him a little bit, and while he wrote back, did you rise to the battle here a little bit?
Not really. I mean, it's part of the enjoyment of public appearances and Q&As and all that. Is that the writer's life is all solitude, and it's all aspiration and anxiety, but it's solitary. Mm-hmm. And I like meeting, never mind about meet the author, I like meeting the reader. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to know that you're making some sort of connection with the outside world, because you wouldn't really know it from what you do all day. So there's something sociable about it. And I'm more and more convinced that the novel itself is a social form. The right position of being the host, and the reader is in the position of being the guest. And those two words, as John DeLillo has reminded us, have the same root. Mm. There's a strange identity between reading and writing. And it's nice to have a face to address things to, or a name, and not this eternal groping, which is what writing really is.
Speaking of DeLillo, you and I admire him, and I seem to like and dislike the same groups of novels. Somebody gave me the names in manuscript form, and because they knew I loved DeLillo, and I struggled to get through it. It was almost unreadable to me. But I did feel, particularly at the time of 9/11, that many of the DeLillo novels that I had read up to that point, Players, Running Dog, White Noise, probably a few others, Underworld, existed in my mind to prepare me for something that I couldn't have known was going to happen, a kind of tragedy, a kind of world-inverting tragedy that I didn't have a lot of equipment for. But he did, I feel like. I feel like in writing those novels, he could somehow or other see what it would be like if the world turned upside down. I think you talk about him as sort of a supreme author of a certain kind of actual real-world terror. Maybe you can say a bit more about that.
Well, I think prescience, or, you know, predicting the future, is not a genuine literary pursuit. There's something in the nature of world events that makes them utterly unpredictable. As Philip Roth said, they're the remorseless unforeseen. And there's something essentially in these events that makes them turn out not as you expected. And anyway, you know, reading a crystal ball is not a sort of respectable literary pursuit. But there are certain writers, and DeLillo is one, J.G. Ballard is another, where you feel they have these supersensitive antennae that do receive transmissions from the near future. And, I mean, there's an extraordinary bit in, I think it's Players, where he imagines the World Trade Center, this is in the 80s, I think, as nothing more than an illusion, two beams of light that go up into the heavens. And that is, in fact, what the World Trade Center became after September the 11th. They became a light show, and that's very striking, I think. It's a sort of serendipity, but it does show something uncanny.
It does.
And in his use of language and dialogue, there's something very distinctive and futuristic about DeLillo.
You mentioned Roth. Your admiration for him seems to know few bounds anyway. Were you surprised when he said he just wasn't going to write anymore? I always expect that Philip Roth will always write and Daniel Day-Lewis will always act. I'm surprised at any age when they remove themselves from the playing field. Were you?
Well, you know, what the rub of time does refer to its effect on writers. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a very dignified way of acknowledging that, just to stop writing beyond a certain point. I mean, this is a completely modern phenomenon given to us, a sort of mixed blessing by medical science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Shakespeare, Dickens, you know, take the canon, certainly the English canon, and they were all dead by the time they were 60, long dead. Shakespeare, 57, Dickens, 58, and then, you know, Jane Austen, 41, Keats, 25. But so we have the doddery novelist is a 20th century arrival. And it's something that you just, it's unavoidable when you read almost anybody. There are exceptions, but where you just see them running out of steam before your eyes, they become diluted and watery. And it's been argued by many that originality and talent are really the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to go on being original beyond, you know, half a century of a writer's life. It gives writers a new responsibility, which is what to do when they feel that the flame is dying.
All right, so we're going to end, as promised, with John Travolta, whom you went and spoke with. There's a great tension in this Travolta piece where he's talking a lot about he's been personally excoriated by, I think, Quentin Tarantino for squandering his gifts. You know, he's told, you know what Pauline Kael said about you. You know what Truffaut said about you. And now you're making these movies where babies talk and dogs talk and he is. And I wonder if that isn't a more universal problem. I mean, everybody who has a talent occasionally has to struggle, is pulled by two serpents, one of them pulling in the direction of cash and the other one of pulling them in the direction of their muses. And I would think any writer, maybe even including you, has had to fight with those two serpents.
Certainly not cash. You must remember that when I started out, it was in the 1973, and my advance to my first novel was £200. And it wasn't a profession that beckoned you with money.
No. And, Samuel Johnson famously said, none but a blockhead ever wrote except for money.
Well, I disagree. I mean, Samuel Johnson said many wonderful things, but that isn't one of them, I don't think. The explosion of interest in, such as it was, in literary fiction came in the early 1980s, and it was, I'm convinced it was to do with the expansion of the media. That the papers got fatter, and what filled these extra columns was not more news, but more features. And then the featureists ran out of, you know, alcoholic actors and furious fashion models and rapist boxers and all the others, and found themselves, sometimes to their horror, writing features about serious writers. So I think, you know, people write the obituary on literary fiction every couple of months. But I think it will go on, but it may well contract. And the literary culture itself will have quite a hard time surviving the internet, I think, is the greatest threat. They said the same of radio, they said it of TV, but the internet attacks the capacity to read a long and more or less demanding book, and the shrinking attention span is likely to hurt literary fiction.
We are going to say farewell here. We've been so lucky to talk to you. Mr. Amos, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for listening. Once again, just in case you tuned in the middle of something, this was an interview with Martin Amis that we did in March of 2018. He died last week. We've tried to update our own understanding and yours. I hope you enjoyed this show.